Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now, from early 2020 to the beginning of this year, Ireland endured three harsh and restrictive lockdowns that severely curtailed every citizen's daily activities. Each decision taken by the government during the pandemic has had incalculable ramifications throughout a period when the entire resources of the state were mobilised to one end, the only comparison for which in recent history is a state of war. A new book entitled Pandemonium takes us inside the rooms where those decisions were made and the ideological battles were won and lost. The authors are Jack Horgan-Jones, political reporter with the Irish Times, and Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with the Sunday Independent and Irish Independent, and they're both here. You're very welcome. Thank you for being here. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
There was one part of the book, there were a number of parts of the book that really struck me, but one part was writing at the very highest levels of government that it was known and understood that the sight of overwhelmed morgues would just be too much. That we just would shred public confidence, and that an effort was made to create this temporary mortuary. And the description of that in Kilmainham, I don't know which one of you wants to just take us through that, because I thought that was just such a stark moment in the book when we were standing on the edge of something and nobody knew where we were headed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when we were talking to people for this book, and Minister of Finance Pascal Donoghue said something that really struck me and stuck with me at the time. He said that this was an existential threat for the state. And I think when you see examples like that, the idea that the hospital system could become overwhelmed to the extent that you literally had nowhere to put the bodies, and they had to, you know, effectively jerry-rig these temporary morgues around the country. Mm-hmm. But also, I think there was a recognition at the highest levels of government, and indeed at the civil service as well, of the effect that that would have, the undermining of confidence in the state itself, its capacity to provide for and to look after its citizens in the face of such a fundamental threat, that that would be, as we say in the book, shredded. And that would in turn potentially have the impact of, you know, leading to civil unrest.
Well, the president was Italy, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a very vivid picture that Ciarán Brown, who's the HSE lead on emergency response, paints of this temporary mortuary in Kilmainham that they'd erected, where there's kind of rows and rows of space for bodies to be put if needs be, if the morgues run out of space.
And if you were going in there, you left your phone outside.
And if you were going in there, you had your phone taken off you, because the idea that a picture of that would get out in March 2020 was something that the state wanted to avoid, the HSE in particular wanted to avoid, but everyone wanted to avoid, because, I mean, we saw the impact of the military trucks transporting bodies in Bergamo, the effect that had, and that was something that everyone involved in Ireland's pandemic response was really keen to avoid right from the off.
Now, thankfully, the plan was in place to deal with far more deaths than we eventually had, but we'll get to some of the moments that happened throughout the pandemic in a moment. But when this was all starting to dawn, you have a great description of Paul Reid, CEO of the HSE, on the golf course in Carrick-on-Shannon. It's January 2020 and his phone is hopping. What was going on?
Well, he was trying to play golf, but
he'd
already fallen, I think, for some way behind his playing companions, and it was some time before he was ever able to get back on the course again. And I think that that shows exactly the disruptive effect that this had on people who are at the very highest echelons of the HSE government and the civil service.
But the calls were saying to him, weren't they?
The calls were saying to him, look, this is coming. There are cases now in Europe. There are cases in Paris and in Bordeaux. And I think it was really at that stage, you know, at the end of January into the start of February, that there began to be this kind of realization that this wouldn't be like something that happened before. It wouldn't be like previous pathogenic threats like SARS or MERS, and that we almost certainly were going to get cases. Although I think even at that stage, it was probably a couple of weeks until people really, really realized the scale of what was coming and the scale of what was going to be required to intervene, which ended up in lockdown. Because in the book, we have documents that were written after those interventions that led to Paul Reid having to cancel his game of golf. And they still say, you know, Ireland is well prepared for a pandemic threat of this nature. You know, we're in good shape. We've planned for this before. And really, I think it was only the last couple of days before we went into lockdown that it was obvious and clear that this was unavoidable and it was going to be a public policy intervention like we've never seen in the history of the state before. An extraordinary time, not just for the people in the cockpit, not just for the people directing the response, but something that enveloped the entire country and reached into every single household.
I mean, the other important point as well is that this was happening in the context of a general election campaign going on at that time, And then the uncertain outcome of the election, where you had three parties on more or less the same number of seats, no clear route to a government being formed. So you have this this government, which is a government and can do all the things that governments do, but I mean, there's no Dáil, it can't pass legislation. And so within this kind of vacuum emerges this pandemic, this crisis. And I suppose, you know, one of the interesting things is the way in which NPHET came about. NPHET is formed at the end of January, in the middle of the election campaign. There's no ministerial decision to do that. There's no cabinet decision to do that. Now, that is not unusual in and of itself, because there had been NPHETs before that. But, you know, NPHET then becomes the preeminent body responsible for all pandemic policy responses over the next 2 years.
And there was tension.
And there was tension, yeah. And there was tension because, for example, Simon Harris and Tony Holohan, and we go into a little bit of detail about this in the book, they had previous over cervical check. There was a fundamental difference of views as to how to approach that. And the minister and Dr. Holohan speak quite frankly about that, you know, that their relations weren't great in the aftermath of that. That had been happening across 2017, 2018, 2019. So in the midst of that comes along this pandemic. But in fairness, both Holohan and Harris kind of just decided that, look, we'll put all this aside and we'll get on with the job because we're facing this existential threat, as others in the book have described to us, and we'll do what it takes. And one thing, I suppose, that Harris made a virtue of was that he moved absolutely in lockstep with Holohan, that whatever he was saying on the radio, and he was in the studio a lot, and he was doing a lot of press conferences, and he was doing a lot of social media, everything that was coming out of his mouth was coming directly from the CMO himself.
So when did that relationship, and I'm not just talking about the individuals, but between NPHET and government, when did it start to sour?
So I think that what happened as we crushed that curve, you know, at the end of that first wave, I think there was a general view amongst politicians and probably the population generally, you know, that, you know, we'd done it and we'd managed to control the virus. And I think that political consensus and wider social consensus to a lesser extent also began to weaken, you know, and the idea that, you know, there was this unanimity between the people who were advising that the government shut down the country and the government itself, that began to dissipate. In the midst of that, you had a new government formed. You had really kind of quite profound changes within the Department of Health, where obviously Tony Holohan went on compassionate leave to care for his wife, but also the sitting Secretary General, the most senior civil servant in the department, someone who's described as like the CEO of the department, who also is responsible for, you know, guiding the minister through the kind of intricacies of internal politics in the Department of Health, Jim Breslin. He stepped away and was replaced on a temporary basis by Colm O'Riordan. And you also had the restarting of parliamentary life to a quite limited degree, but you had the COVID committee, which was set up to kind of invigilate and analyse the response, but also what was happening in real time. So I think that the sands kind of subtly but fundamentally shifted as we moved through into summer of 2020. Mm-hmm. And into that context, you also get a new minister who's asked to kind of to react to all this.
I think you get a view within the political system and outside of it as well, that is there another way to do this? Do we have to do harsh lockdowns? Why couldn't we do the Sweden approach, for example? And so within that, you know, you have the COVID committee bringing in all these experts and they're challenging the public health officials who are responsible in Ireland for the response here as to, you know, whether their decisions were the right decisions. And there's a chapter in the book called Gobshitery on Speed, which is what one official described that kind of committee and the sort of activities that it got up to that summer. Because there's a belief, and I think Ronan Glynn articulates this in the book, that it started, the public sort of buy-in to this is the only approach, the lockdown is the best approach to suppress the disease. You know, there was a fraying of that somewhat, and people started to ask, you know, is there a different way of doing this? And so then throughout that summer, you have debates about, well, could we have green zones, for example, where we could have more freedoms than in other parts of the country where the disease is taking off. We had the local lockdowns that summer, for example, in Kildare, Laois and Offaly. So this becomes the debate heading into the autumn as to whether there are different approaches. And of course, as well in the book, we have Leo Varadkar talking about replacing NPHET with some other body that might have more expertise on it from different facets of society. Stephen Donnelly, when he came into office, was also quite keen and had spoken about this in opposition to reform NPHET in some way, to add economists, to add more science to it, and so on and so forth. But that all kind of falls apart then as we get into October. The CMO comes back and we have this extraordinary
row. What is interesting is that on the political side, they seem to have diagnosed some of the issues with NEFA, for want of a better word. You know, I think the Taoiseach describes it in the book as a suboptimal structure. So they weren't delighted with it, but they never did anything really to try to reform it. There always seemed to be a reason not to do it. So when Varadkar was leaving office, it was because he was leaving office, and perhaps that's something the new Taoiseach would want to do in the aftermath of the well-publicised October blow-up. It was, well, you know, we're far from delighted with these guys at the moment, but now is not the time to be seen to be going in there and tearing up trees, because we seem to be vindictive, you know?
Remind us about what happened in October, because, like, Tony comes back and it's like flicking a switch. What happened?
So he comes back, I think, 3 or 4 days before he's due to come back into the department formally to resume his job, his day job. And he's been looking at the data, and he's worried, and he says this to us in the book. He said, you know, I'd been looking at the data, I'd been looking at what was happening in Western Europe. The disease was coming back in a big way. So he could see the trend, and it wasn't a good trend. So he decides that he wants to call an emergency NEFIT meeting. He informs the minister of this on the Saturday morning, that he's calling an NEFIT meeting for the next day. And then the CMO and Stephen Donnelly don't speak for another 24 hours. Now, that is the subject of some controversy subsequent to that. There was dull debates. The minister had to explain himself and so on. And the minister in the book does kind of allude to, I suppose, some degree of regret that he didn't pick up the phone that Saturday. He said that if he was doing it again, maybe he would have picked up the phone that Saturday. But nonetheless, he argues he spoke to him on the Sunday. The meeting was going ahead. The meeting goes ahead. It recommends, this is the emergency NEFIT meeting, that the CMO is quite clear that level 3 restrictions won't cut it. We need a full level 5 lockdown. That's the recommendation from NEFIT. This surprises the political system. They feel bounced into it. And I suppose more importantly, it leaks. I think Micheál Lehane from this parish tweets about it around 9 o'clock or leading up to 9 o'clock that Sunday evening. And it causes huge ructions and leads to a very stormy
meeting
the next
day.
And this
is when Leo Varadkar then on
your show
on the Monday night came out and let fly. Yeah. Well, he doesn't accept that he let fly, but he let fly at NEFIT and as people who are making these decisions.
And there's a deep souring of relations that flows from this, and we have NEFIT members on the record in the book talking about, you know, the damage that Varadkar did to himself, not only amongst people on NEFIT, but also within the wider medical community. And I think that what happens in the course of that interview, but also in a very ugly meeting the next day between the NEFIT chiefs and the government itself, where, you know, they're basically thrown out of the room at the end of it, is there is this souring of relations. And that kind of, it's our view, and I suppose the view of the book, that what happens in October kind of contaminates the next few months, because even though the government end up taking the advice of NEFIT a couple of weeks later, and we do end up in the lockdown, the second lockdown that was originally advised, there is this schism that emerges, you know, and one good example of that in the book is this sense on the government side and on the side of the civil servants, the non-NEFIT side, that, you know, NEFIT had all the stats and graphs and numbers, and that because they had that, they were able to kind of set the pace and, you know, define the terms of the public debate, because they were able to say which way the pandemic is going. And this idea emerges, actually pitched to government by one of the consultancy firms, EY, of this kind of, I think we describe it in the book as a
Orwellian
surveillance state, you know, this architecture put
downright
together.
Creepy is another
well,
phrase that
you describe it.
Well, no, it's in your book. So some of the putative inputs were downright creepy. So you better explain to us what this is. This is a bizarre revelation about this one government centre plan.
Yes. It was basically marshalling all of the data from credit card companies, from
At its most intrusive, and
mobile companies,
the library,
Ireland data. Yeah, who knew?
It's important to say that, you know, this was a plan that was only executed in a very limited way, and not to the extent that was originally envisaged. But there were interventions suggested, like using CCTV to detect issues of non-compliance and then direct enforcement.
They came up with this idea of a social distancing index, I think, SDI, and this would be kind of a way in which to measure whether people were compliant with social distancing within society.
What would they
using
do to
CCTV.
Us if we weren't?
Who knows? Never got that far.
Yeah. But this was a suggestion which came from the consultancy company,
it did,
EY.
It did. And within government, there was a view that we're not going to go down this path. And I think one senior official is quoted in the book saying that we decided not to go in this this direction, because we knew that like it wouldn't be a thing that we, you know, would pass muster with the public here. And in fairness, you know, there was a high degree of compliance right through the pandemic with restrictions.
But what so it does illustrate, I think, you know, the possibility of this even being entertained, the possibility of this, you know, being commissioned, you know, this kind of thought exercise, I think shows the degree to which relationships were damaged. And we shouldn't forget that what happened immediately after that is the divergence, the single big divergence in direction between the policies that were advised and the approach that was taken, which is Christmas. So our view is that, you know, everything up to that point is kind of conditioned by what happened in October, and the legacy of October in many ways is Christmas 2020.
Yes, where we had limited reopening of pubs and restaurants, and then we also had the household visits.
Yeah. So we open up the hospitality at the beginning of December, and then we open up household visits in the middle of December.
And the advice was not to do both.
The advice was not to do, but I mean, we go into this in some detail within the book, and senior government figures are on the record saying that effectively we felt we had a choice here, that we could, you know, we could do a little bit of one and a little bit of the other, whereas NPHET figures are quite clear that their advice was not, that you could not do that. That you had to do one or the other.
Yeah.
And they recommended keeping hospitality closed because they, in NPHET's view, you know, there was an important thing around household visits and Christmas and families getting together in a limited way if they could. But what happened was, is hospitality opens in December, people enjoy the hospitality in December, and then they go into the households and the disease spreads, and it did spread. And that leads to a situation around Christmas time, and we go into this in some detail in the book, because we don't think it was, you know, it didn't really emerge at the time, but there was repeated warnings from the CMO from kind of the 21st of December onwards that a full level 5 lockdown was necessary. And I think he advised that the full suite of level 5 should be in place from the 26th of December. The government doesn't actually bring in full level 5 measures as stipulated in the Living with COVID plan, I think, until the 30th of December.
So, and then we all remember just how dark that post-Christmas winter was.
It's referred to, and the part in the book is called The Tunnel, and that's taken actually from another Pascal Donoghue quote, who apparently in a meeting where this was all being outlaid for government, the health chiefs were saying, look, this is just how serious the situation is, how deep we are in. And he says, how long is the tunnel? Meaning, you know, is there light at the end of the tunnel? And they turned to him and they just said, we don't know. And, you know, that was, I think, the depths and the darkest moments for many people. And really, actually, you know, even though we covered that in real time in our day jobs, certainly I hadn't realised just how close to collapse or partial collapse the healthcare system came. Like, there was there's an internal HSE audit that's detailed in the book, which basically says many ICUs were at the point of collapse, and it was only through this mobile ambulance service called MICAS where patients were evacuated and brought to ICUs that were under less pressure that total disaster was averted. And Kieran Brown, who was responsible for setting up those morgues in the first place, tells us again, you know, that we came much closer to collapse, and there were several instances in hospitals, particularly in Dublin and the eastern region, where, you know, they went into weekends going, do we actually have enough room for the people who are going to die over this weekend? And again, that's one of the starkest moments.
I think everyone who we spoke to for the book was agreed that January 2021 was the darkest point in the entire 2 years. You know, we never got as close then as we did since or before that as we did then to the sort of Bergamo style situation.
I want to talk to you about the interpersonal relationships and the chats that you had with people. And I was surprised that people were as frank as they were with you what they thought about people. So Dr. Tony Holohan, I mean, regarded by many as a hero of the pandemic, but he's a divisive person, right? You know, people were very open with you in saying that there were times when the room was divided, to say the least.
Yeah, and I suppose people, his style of running NPHET meetings was the subject of some debate amongst those we spoke to. You know, some people saw it as he tried to build consensus. Others saw it as kind of attrition warfare, where he's basically trying to wear people down at these really long meetings. I mean, there was one meeting, I think, in November 2020 that went on for 8 hours. One member told us that they went to the dentist in the middle of the meeting and they had the meeting on in their earphones.
Not sure which experience is more painful.
Yeah, indeed. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, Kevin Kelleher, a former senior official in the HSE responsible for, I think, not infectious diseases, but he was...
He did a lot of work on schools.
He did a lot of work on schools, but he said that he felt the debate was controlled to ensure certain outcomes were achieved. I felt ignored. I felt this happened overtly to myself and others. I mean, that's quite a strong view as to how NPHET meetings were conducted. But I suppose, you know, others in the book, I mean, even, you know, Colm Henry, the HSE
Chief Clinical
Officer, I think he described Tony Holland as Tertullian, didn't
Tertullian, yeah, yeah. And I suppose that's the argument, particularly during that first wave, to go a little bit back in time, is that, you know, Tony Holland is someone who did have a kind of intuitive understanding of the pandemic and a very clear vision for what had to be done. And, you know, in order to achieve that, he wasn't afraid to go in there and be what two sources at least describing the book a little bit dictatorial when it came to when it came to Neffet. You know,
he felt he knew where he needed to get to.
But he had also a vision, kind of calloused by his experiences, I think, of cervical check, for example. He's a long time public servant, long time chief medical officer, going back to 2009. He was deputy before that, and he knew, I suppose he had in the back of his head this idea that, you know, at some point I'll have to account for all this.
And listen, Paul Reid, HSE CEO, very frank with you about his views on Stephen Donnelly, the health minister, saying he riled up the staff when he came in.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually. I mean, the minister addressed this last night at a press conference held over the National Maternity Hospital. He was asked about this, and he said, "Hey, look, my style is to challenge people, and I don't mind pushing people around." I'm paraphrasing a little, but, you know, he certainly hasn't denied that, you know, he was not afraid to go in and try and put his stamp on things, so he's making a virtue of it. I mean, one thing that we do see time and time again throughout the book is that, you know, that Stephen Donnelly did have a style at times that would rub people up the wrong way, and that people, when we were reporting it in the course of it, did kind of consistently raise issues, you know, around his political judgment or skill on certain topics, you know, so antigen testing being a very obvious example of something where he made a clear political commitment to getting antigen testing into the state's armory when it came to the COVID response, but ran up against quite significant resistance from the HSE and from Neffet, and ultimately for a period of months was embroiled in a rather public standoff where he couldn't land this policy objective, you know. So,
and what did Stephen Donnelly say to you when you put the criticisms made of him to him?
Well, I mean, I think his view is that he is his style. I mean, as he said last night in the press conference, he's pushy, you know, and he challenging discussions do take place. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think his view is that he was trying to find ways in which we could better manage our response to the pandemic. And that involved, for example, drawing on big data. He self-described data guy. The EY stuff we spoke to earlier, he wasn't aware of the One Government Centre proposal, but he certainly endorsed the idea of consultants like EY coming in and having a look at the data and different ways in which the data could be manipulated. I suppose, were there things that we could learn about this? I mean, there's a scene in the book where Donnelly over a weekend is crunching the numbers on emergency admissions into hospitals. There's some hospital data anyway, and he's crunching that and he's sending it to Deirdre Galland, the Taoiseach's chief of staff, on a Sunday evening, saying, "Look, I've crunched this data, and here's what it's telling us." And that was his approach. And I suppose other ministers might delegate that work to official, but he was very hands on, and he speaks to this in the book in some detail. He likes to get involved, and he likes to know.
So he likes that side. He likes the graphs, the charts, the numbers. But maybe on the political side, were there doubts expressed that perhaps the political decision and how this would fly with people was not taken
into consideration? Certainly, Donnelly has made a virtue throughout his political career of, you know, "I came from a private sector background. I don't come from a political family. I wasn't a county councillor before this." So his way of doing politics is not a way, I think, that an awful lot of politicians in the system here are used to. Therefore, it does, as Jack said, rub people up the wrong way. And it also, I suppose, shows that in some instances he's not able to pull the levers of government effectively to achieve the outcomes that he wants. I mean, there's multiple examples in the book of memos going to cabinet that either have to be pulled, redrafted, or don't get considered that week and go back. And I mean, we saw last night, for example, the National Maternity Hospital memo has to go back for further consideration.
I'm going to have to leave it there, but just really quickly, are we ready for the next pandemic?
I think we're more ready than we were at the start of this pandemic. But I think that one of the key takeaways from this book, which has to be, I think, elucidated through a public inquiry at this stage as well, given what's happened, is that, you know, all our efforts should be directed at ending up in a situation where we don't have to go back to a lockdown policy, because the costs of lockdown, economic, social, personal, healthcare costs, even though it's justified on its own terms, in terms of saving human lives, which is a worthwhile endeavour, they are so huge and so unquantifiable that it should be, I think, the last option if we do have to face the next pandemic.
The book is called Pandemonium: Power, Politics and Ireland's Pandemic. It's written by Jack Horgan-Jones and Hugh O'Connell. It's a fascinating read. Thank you both very much for coming in to talk to us. Published by Gill Books. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.